The Beer EDU Podcast, Episode 99, Creative Assessments, Batsheva Frankel. Welcome to the Beer EDU Podcast, the podcast for educators that love to learn and share ideas with fellow educators over beers, with your hosts, Kyle Anderson and Ben Dixon.
What's up, Kyle?
Benjamin, how are we doing today?
I am good, my friend. I am good. So, hey, another episode of the Beer EDU Podcast. I believe this is episode...
This is 99.
Okay, so
episode 99. So
I'm like, yep. this is it. We're almost to the big one.
We're almost there. We're right there. So, and you know, as we're recording this, we've already got our guests lined up for episode 100. Yes. And we'll be recording that, and it's going to be, let's just say it's going to be a banger.
It'll be well worth. Yes.
Yes.
If you only listen to one episode, which would mean you're already listening to this one, but anyway,
so yeah. Two episodes. So yes. This one though, I think is going to be a banger though too. So yes. we'll get into that here. Yeah. We'll get into that here in a few minutes, but first I am Kyle Anderson. I am a special education teacher in Las Vegas. You can find me on Twitter @AndersonEdTech. Same thing with the Instagram. And my blog is AndersonEdTech.net. And then I have a book called To the Edge, Successes and Failures to Risk Taking, available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and my publisher, EduMatch Publishing. And you, sir, you are?
I am Ben Dixon. I am a principal in Reno, Nevada, north of you, my friend. And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram @BDixonNV. And if this is the Beer EDU Podcast, we have beers. So, Kyle, what do you have for us tonight?
Well, I cheated and looked ahead to see what you were drinking as well. And I will say that I have a complete and utter opposite.
Opposite beers.
Yes, of what you have today. So I have a Lagunitas with you. Bay Area Brewery, very popular nationwide now because I believe they have a brewery in Chicago too. I have their Willetized Coffee Stout aged in rye oak barrels. So It's got a lot going on, at least on the surface. This one is a boozer, 13.1% ABV, 60 IBU. So Imperial Stout, aged, you know, it's got a lot of bang for the buck there. So a lot of chocolate, a lot of coffee flavors. There's that mellow spice you get from the rye.
Right.
You know, a good whiskey, rye whiskey, has that nice little spice kick to it, that peppery. Mm-hmm. Very smooth. This is not drinking like a 13.1.
Wow.
I've got another one in the fridge. So if I slug this one down and go get another one, it could get ugly towards the end. But I'm going to refrain from doing so because that's just bad news right there. So, But like I said, you have something completely different. I will say I had one of these the other night and it's really good.
So this is the exact opposite of what you have. So I have a Firestone Walker, so out of Paso Robles Brewery, another West Coast brewer. They're 805, which you see everywhere, but this is the 805 Cerveza. So this one is their light lager with a hint of lemon. And this is, you know, at 4.5% ABV and it's no IBUs. This is the quintessential lawnmower beer. This is
For sure.
The exact opposite of your beer.
I think there's actually a little bit of salt in that too. So as you're mowing the lawn and it's 95 and you're sweating, you're getting your electrolytes too.
It's one of those ones that like they, so the problem with the lawnmower beer is that next thing you know, I'm like, my wife goes, you know, there's four empty bottles on the counter. And I was like, I've had four of these. I didn't even realize it. So, I mean, mine is crazy, crazy smooth. So, which I mean, yours is smooth too, but mine's in a different way.
Yes, indeed. So, I am not going to be mowing the lawn with this one. So, and the fact that as we're recording this, it had been really nice here in Las Vegas, like in the 80s for a few days. And then all of a sudden today, it was only like 58. So, it's not necessarily cold, but it feels a lot colder than what it really is. So, this is actually really nice for the weather that we're having right now. And they're even calling for a little bit of rain. Who knows if that's going to show up though. So
I don't know. It was 29 degrees when I got up and there was ice all over my driveway. So anyways, I'm not going to complain. But
so we have a guest and really excited about this guest. We've been talking now for a while, and she insisted that not a beer drinker, but asked ahead of time. So nice. Right. Asked if she could have a wee dram of whiskey instead. And we said, of course, because we are whiskey fans as well. So let's take a moment to welcome Batsheva Frankel to the podcast. Hey, how's it going?
Good. It's great. Thank you so much for having me. You guys are so fun.
We're super excited because we were already talking before the show about your drink. And so we're just going to jump right in and you have to share what you have because I'm impressed. I'm excited about this.
So I actually brought two because I had to, you guys have such amazing beers. And so I had to impress a little bit. So the first one is my Glenfiddich 15. I don't know if you'll be able to see it here, but yeah. I have one dram of that happening. And then I have, my husband and I splurged and we got this sent from Scotland. It's called Sassenach. And it's actually a reference to Outlander because one of the main actors from Outlander is the creator of this scotch. And and that's a really, really good one. So I'm starting with that one. We'll start there.
Nice.
We'll see what happens. And I learned when I was in Scotland, I learned that after you drink it a little bit, you put a little bit of water in it and it kind of changes the whole taste. It's lovely. So I have a glass here with some ice water. You can't really see it, but I'll be, you know, gently pouring that in. And as I mentioned before, I hope I'm coherent by the end of this.
I just find it funny that Glenfiddich is such a iconic and just glorious scotch and that you're lowering your standards with that one.
It's the cheap one. It's like drinking Coors Light. It's like Coors Light before the other one.
No. It's really, really good too. I enjoy it very much.
Right. Yeah. So, well, once again, welcome. Thanks for taking some time out to join us here. So, but let's learn a little bit more about you. Like, who is Batsheva and what do you do? What things in education make you tick? What are you passionate about? Tell us all about yourself.
Oh my goodness. So I've been an educator for over 25 years. And one of my biggest passions has always been to make education exciting, fun, engaging. Something that students really want to do. And as I've been going along in it, you know, you learn more and more and more. And the last school I was at is actually the sponsor of my podcast. I have a podcast called Overthrowing Education, and which is a lot of fun. And that was from the sponsor of that is the Arete Preparatory Academy. And when I started working there, I was really the head there, Jim Hahn, and I just really connected on educational philosophy. He created the school and he created it with sort of the ideas of, you know, what he was thinking about education. And as our ideas kept growing and progressing, we kept adding that to the school. And then we dreamed up what would be the most amazing middle school experience. And then he created it. And so, so I got to see that happen, like, your fantasy school, there it is. So my goal with Overthrowing Education is to really help people, educators and parents, know what great education could and should be and how to create it and how to advocate for it when it's not there. And also the other thing that I do, I'm an educational consultant and I have my own company. It's called New Lens Ed. I have a new course that I have a method called Lenses of Questioning that I've been teaching all over the world. And it's been just amazing. And basically what it is helping students ask a wider variety of kind of question. And it's a really fun methodology. There's even a gamified part to it and so forth. I'm really into game-based learning. And I've created my own learning games that deal with like big philosophical issues for teens and preteens that are a lot of fun. And so, with Lenses of Questioning, it's just been so popular that I finally just created an asynchronous course that teachers can take. And it's just a great method. It's really fun. And that's what I do. And I'm at New Lens Ed. If anybody wants to find me or Twitter at Batsheva Frankel or Twitter at Overthrowing Ed.
So that's it. Yeah, so I'm curious about So in your role now, so the class you have, it's asynchronous. Thinking about all the changes that went on this year with schools going remote and everything, were you already in that mode with your company and the work you're providing?
It's so interesting that you asked that. So I had been giving workshops. I was working like part-time still that last year. I was working part-time, started my podcast working for Arete and doing some remote classes there when we went remote. But mostly like for the last few years, people would just fly me out to Seattle or New York or England or wherever they wanted to, for me to come teach these workshops. And then what happened when everything went remote, I went, oh my gosh, these teachers need some help. I got to be there for them. So I gave, the first thing I did is I gave this free workshop about tech tools that you can use online to engage your students. And I had like 250 teachers in that workshop. It was crazy. And so what I saw is how much, one of the things that was really beautiful is that there were all these teachers who never used tech in their classroom ever. And here I was getting this opportunity to teach them tech tools and pedagogical ways to use them and to be creative and all of those things to engage their students that they can take with them back into the classroom when they go, you know, in person, and some teachers are now back in person. But I've been giving these workshops on different tech tools and different ways to engage students in creating community and making how to do creative and authentic assessments, how to gamify. I taught at ISTE about how to gamify your humanities curriculum with something I call Battle of the Big Ideas. And I'm teaching a 4-hour deep dive at the Deeper Learning Conference at the end of March about how to create deeper learning games. So everything's online now. Like it's been amazing for my business. It's been amazing for me to get to help teachers all over the country that maybe couldn't afford to bring me in. And my only sad thing is that when this is all over, that people are going to be so used to just bringing me in virtually that no one will bring me in anymore and fly me in and put me up in a nice hotel. I won't get to do that anymore.
I think people are itching for some sort of, I don't think this is going away though. I think that what you described is exactly what, like, I think about like a school like mine or a district like mine, where we're a big district, clearly not as big as Kyle's, but we're a big district and we can bring in bigger names. But like some of our, cause we're county districts, some of our smaller, like where Kyle used to be in Carson, which is our capital, they couldn't afford to bring in, a PD for their whole staff and things like that. So
that's what I'm hoping that I'll get to do both. Cool. There's benefits to doing the PD online, especially when you're doing tech tools. It's actually really, really helpful. But then there's some that I do that I want to be in person for. When I'm doing my lenses of questioning, I've done it online before and it totally works, but I really love doing it in person. And I love, like, I'm going to be doing this, the 4-hour deep dive on creating games.
Right.
It was really interesting. I was supposed to do that in person and then they canceled it last March. I'm doing it this March, but we're doing it virtually. We send home kits for everybody because there's this whole, like, you have to make the thing kind of component. So we sent these like really cool kits to everybody who's going to be in that deep dive so that they could do the activity. But it's so weird because usually, you know, it's live and it's collaborative. And so now it's breakout rooms, but it's great. I mean, it's really been good. I'm most impressed with the way so many teachers are stepping up their game right now. And I know that it will be great. And the other thing that I appreciate is the focus on some really big issues that I feel like I've been trumpeting for a long time. And I feel like now other people are really seeing the importance of it, like reassessing grades and, excuse me, that we don't need grades. Like, why are we still doing that? Why are we still doing standardized tests? Why are we doing assessments? My favorite question is like, well, how do I give that test online when they could just cheat? And my answer is, if you're giving an assessment where they can cheat, then it's not a good assessment. It's like, what is that? That just means they're regurgitating something that, you know, that's just information. We can find information out on our phones and Google and everything else. We don't really need to test people on something they could just look up. What we need to do is create assessments that really get students to synthesize the material and critically think about it and show their analyzation skills and shows how they can transfer that information into, you know, either real world or in a creative way. Those are the kinds of things that we need to do. And so I'm hoping that when this is all over, that that will stick a little bit or a lot of it. Yeah.
And yeah, there's definitely something to be said about in-person training. And like Ben said, I don't think it's going to go away, but this isn't going to go away either. It's just going to provide more options for professional development, in my opinion. And I know, like, I've done some presentations in the virtual format since this has all happened. And the thing that I struggle with the most when doing those presentations, and maybe you can speak for this as well, is that you can't read a room like you can when it's live. I mean, and that's just like when you're teaching as well. Like, you can't read a room of kids online when it's just icons and nobody's unmuting and very rarely using the chat. And it's the same way with adult learners. So adult learners will complain that kids don't turn on their cameras. They're not engaging very well, but then they're doing the same thing in a virtual format as well. Whereas I feel like when you're doing it in person, it, maybe the engagement's not as strong, but at least you can read that a little bit. And
the jokes, the dumb jokes
I tell, they land a little bit differently in person than they do online. So, I mean, you get a sticker or two, at least in person, where some, when it's just that silence, you're just like, oh, that one was really bad. Now I know how a comedian feels on a bad night or whatever. So
or trying to do their comedy show on Zoom. I agree with you. And I'm teaching two courses to students in other states on podcasting, because that's something else I do, is teach teens how to podcast. And it's been a lot of fun. But one of the classes, most of the kids keep their cameras off. And it's so hard. And the other one, they're kind, and there's only like five of them in that class. And so they keep their cameras on, and it's really, really helps. It's so hard when everybody's got their cameras off. You're just talking to yourself. Cause that's the other thing, is you can see yourself, and then it's just really frustrating. And I do notice that sometimes adults do that, but it depends. If it's a huge workshop, you know, like 150 or whatever, then you get at least 20 people, and that's all you need. You just need to see some faces. So I don't mind that. And I keep them engaged and interactive. I don't do any lectures. Even when I'm a keynote speaker, I tell people when they want to bring me in as a keynote speaker, I'm like, well, as long as you know that I'm not actually going to get up and lecture for 45 minutes, I'm going to do an interactive workshop that they will be involved in. I don't care if it's 80 to or 400 people or whatever. They're going to be doing stuff. So, I don't know where that was going. That's the problem with all that scotch.
So. There we go. So I want to go back, and I'm really fascinated about the take you have on grading and those things, because it is something that I think I know in my district we're talking about, because we have kids online, we have kids face to face, and clearly that's two different worlds. And how do you grade? And I'm on record in my school as saying I think grades are dumb. I, as a classroom teacher, I was very lucky that in the last two schools that I worked in, we were standards-based grading, which to me made more sense. It's like, can the kid do it? 1, 2, 3, or 4? And they progressed along. And it wasn't like an arbitrary C or a D. And we can get into a whole discussion. I also worked at a project-based learning school where we did more project-based learning. So that's moving away. But I mean, are you seeing, I guess my question would be, are you seeing more districts reach out for that? I mean, is that...
I'm seeing more schools and districts doing it, and I'm also seeing like the two I just put out my 43rd. I only put out an episode every other week. So I've just put out my 43rd episode, and the two episodes that absolutely kill, you can see which ones are really popular. Mm-hmm. The two most popular are both about going gradeless. And one of them is just called Going Gradeless. And the other one is called Why Grades Fail Us. And it was actually my first episode that I did, because I really felt like I want to start this off. I mean, it's called Overthrowing Education. So I better be a little bit radical at the beginning. So I think it's taking hold. I think people are really, it's generating interest, this idea. So I think it's going to grow. I think people are just scared because they don't really know how to do it. And it's wonderful just to give feedback to students. Can you imagine how less anxious students would be if you just gave them, you know, feedback and worked with them, and they could work on what they did until they master it. And they just taking off that pressure of, and being labeled, you know, I'm a C student or whatever.
So how do you, what's your argument? Because this is the argument I always hear is like, well, what about college? Like the kids aren't going to have grades. They're not going to have GPAs. Like, how are they going to get into college? I mean, how do you address that?
Okay. So there's two things I would say. One of them is that is an irrelevant argument for elementary school and middle school, completely irrelevant. In our high school so far, and I think that schools are going to stop, colleges are going to at some point stop caring about those things. Mm-hmm. But at this point, like for Arete, his last school, and we totally went feedback only. I didn't put a grade on there for, I don't know, 7 years. I just did feedback. And then when we did have to do grades, because they are high school and they have to go to college, or they don't have to go to college, but if they want to go to college, then we do put a grade for the end of the semester and the end of the year. But the students are never surprised by their grade because they, and then I learned something on my first episode. I learned something from Jesse Stommel, and he said, he talks about how he does it with his students. Like he says, what grade do you think you deserve? And then they talk about it. What an amazing conversation. So I did that with my, I was teaching at the time an honors English class, two honors English classes. And I did that with my students. And I said, what grade do you feel that you deserve? And they're really honest about it. And we talk about why, and, you know, and I thought, oh, I wish I had done that all along too, because that would have been really amazing. And, you know, the teacher ultimately, if they under, they rarely over, they're not really that delusional because you've been letting them know all along, right?
They're probably harder. Yeah. They're usually harder on themselves.
Yeah. Especially, I hate to say it, especially the girls. And you have to say, why did you say A minus when you know that you're amazing? You should get an A. I'm like, I don't know. But that's when you, as a teacher, come in and say, no, it's an A. Okay. And I hate having to even say it's an A, you know, like I hate that, but that's what, you know, for now, that's the way I get around it. It's just a matter of like not putting points on a paper, not putting grades on papers. I don't give tests or quizzes because I do, as I mentioned, I do authentic and creative assessments, which are so much more amazing. And you can tell so much more about what students know when you do assessments like that. It's really powerful. And so those are great because they're so, you know, you can even do it with the students. You know, what do you think? What do you think you should get on this assessment? Did you, you know, do you feel like you expressed what you knew well? And, you know, just having those conversations. We're just giving them feedback. And by the way, and if they blow it, you know, they're also, sometimes they're presenting them for the class or other people. So you have them critique and give constructive critique and then let them do it again. If I'm not going to, like, it's not, like, sometimes, you know, people do a test and it's so final. It's like, well, that's it. You got a C. You're done. Right. Let's move on. But if I got a C, then I'm not really ready to move on.
Right.
You know, I need to do that material again if that's the point. So
that reminds me a lot of like at a school like High Tech High or one of those, the schools that use the project-based learning, and that they do that portfolio where the kids will present to a group of peers and then they get honest feedback about their work. And it's very similar to that. It's a very authentic. It's much like your job. Your job is a lot of times when you have a job, maybe outside of education, you do a project, you either present to your team or something like that. You're going to get feedback. Right. You know, it's not you got an A on that project that you did for the company. Good job. You know, but doesn't work that way.
To piggyback that, Ben, I worked at a school in Las Vegas a few years ago that was modeled off a High Tech High and project-based learning and, I've never been to High Tech High, but I've heard that there's not necessarily a bell schedule. There's like this suggested bell schedule. Kids kind of come and go, not as they please, but we weren't that lax when it came to those kinds of things, but you're right. When we did a project and they would present it to a group, it was not only you're presenting to your peers in your class, but you're presenting to peers in other classes.
Right.
At the same time. And then you always had a panel of judges. Mm-hmm. It may be a panel of judges that are other teachers in the hall or from around the building or whatever. And then I know for the program classes, whether it was, I taught kids that were always in either culinary or the marketing program, the marketing teachers would bring in executives from Las Vegas casinos and restaurants.
Amazing.
And, And then the culinary teachers, they would have, you know, maybe a culinary teacher from another school would take a day to come over and look. But then you're talking about executive chefs from like really high end restaurants in Las Vegas. And, you know, let's be honest, Las Vegas has some of the best restaurants in the world. So, and the result of this was not only getting authentic feedback on something that wasn't just a pencil and paper test where how many cups of sugar do you add to this cake recipe? It wasn't like that. Like the kid would bake a cake and then somebody would come in and taste it and then give feedback like, you know, this cake, it was the perfect amount of sweetness, but you may have beat the batter a little bit too much because it was a little bit dense. So that's authentic feedback. It wasn't a pass fail or anything like that. And then turn around, fast forward a couple of years later, those kids are graduated from school. They're working as sous chefs in some of these restaurants. I've got a kid that started as a sous chef at Lavo, which is a high-end Italian restaurant, the Venetian. Right. And now I believe he's like one of the, I don't know if he's the executive head chef, but he's one of the high-end chefs at Lavo now as a result of that. So it opens doors, not just for, you know, it's school grades, passing classes, earning credits, whatever. It opens doors for a career down the road as well.
Right. Yeah. It also helps students develop what their passions are. And I love, you know, what you're saying and what you're doing and authentic assessments. That's exactly it. You bring in that real life audience and you, whoever, so that they're also getting exposed to what their passions might be. I have students who became filmmakers because they were making films in my class, and it's not a filmmaking class. It's just, that's what we did. Right. So, and they were just fell in love with it. And they were like, that's what I want to do.
And I think it's, and we, that was one of the best things we did at the school, the last school before I was at the school I'm at, is we took a group of teachers to LA and we went down to Southern California and we went to High Tech High. And then we went to High Tech Elementary, which was phenomenal, which was cool because we brought a bunch of teachers who were very traditional type of teaching. We use a, you know, this is our math program. This is a, and they had the same math program. They had the same, and the teachers were like, they're using the same stuff we are. And I'm like, we're like, yes, they are. But look what else they're doing. They're doing these like big elaborate projects and the kids do them throughout the year. And the kids are, like you said, fully invested. I mean, I loved High Tech High. I was like, I went to a vocational school. That's how I graduated. It was very kind of similar to that, like kind of different pace. It was very hands-on. And so I would love to see us move towards that, where like you're describing, where it's not about the grade, it's not about the test, it's about like, how are you taking what you've learned and applying it? Right. Because in the real world, it's not a test. Right. It's not 50 math problems on a sheet.
Right. Your test is, you know, did you do it well?
Right.
You know,
right.
That's your test.
Yeah.
And that's really what we should be gearing our, if we keep talking about preparing our students for the future, then we need to actually, first of all, we need to prepare them for now. Like, yes, the future, that's important too, but they should be, we should be worrying about them now. We need to make sure that we're not squashing their curiosity, that we're actually connecting them to their curiosity, that we're actually cultivating their curiosity, that we're the, and that's one of the reasons why I do lenses of questioning, is to help them to ask great questions that will lead to deeper learning. Because right now our system is like squashing the creativity, squashing the curiosity, and we're going to see the results of that, where we've already seen it. It's really a big problem. The other thing I want to say about High Tech High, I've been to there because I was at the Deeper Learning Conference a few years ago when it was in person, and it was there. And I was teaching actually lenses questioning, but it's amazing. But what I also love is it's cross-curricular.
Yes.
And that is another thing of mine, my little soapbox, is about how important it is to do cross-curricular learning. Mm-hmm. And I don't see that enough. Everything is like in its little, now you're doing math, now you're doing science, now you're doing English. We don't do that in real life, right? Like you use everything. And that's why I love that baking example that you gave, because that includes math, science, you know, you have to know how to read and understand. You know, have to be able to do this thing. You have to be able to translate it. So I love that idea because it really incorporates all of those skills. It's very cross-curricular. I just want to mention a really fun assessment I did and your baking thing. I've done two kind of versions of this when I had students. I also try to match my assessments to the students' passions. And if there's a lot of different ones, then I give lots of different choices for how they can express what they know and understand. But I had students who really loved baking and cooking. One year was baking, the other year was cooking. So for the baking, I did for Midsummer Night's Dream. I did the Midsummer Night's Dream Dreamy Dessert Challenge. And they had to create a recipe, an original recipe, that expressed through its ingredients and the description of the recipe. They had to show their understanding of the characters and the interplay and the themes. And then they had to create the dessert and present it for a panel. And I brought in a panel, not as cool as your panel, Kyle. I mean, that's just like, it wasn't that cool. But it was still like a panel that wasn't me and not the other classmates. And they had to present their dessert and they had to talk about why they created this. And the title had to, you know, everything had to tie into Midsummer Night's Dream. So that was really, really fun, super successful. And then I love that, John. And then the other one that I did was I did a book called Like Water for Chocolate, and it has magical realism in it, and the story is told through these recipes. It's really, if you haven't read it, it's a great book. And so for their final assignment, they had to write a short story that was about an incident in their life, but they had to add magical realism so I could see, did they understand how to use magical realism in their own writing. And they had to create a recipe. They had to kind of write it in the style that she did with a recipe. And then they made the recipe. And so we got to, I had an outside panel of people come in and they had to present what they made. And then, you know, the students could eat it and the judges ate it. And then they had to read their story out loud. And it was really great. And one of the students didn't really get enough magical realism. And the other students kind of pointed it out, like that it was missing. And so I let her do it again. And she rewrote it. It was amazing. So
you mentioned in there that you love something that John said. So for those listening, we are live and we have live comments coming in. And John Van Dusen just comments as we were talking about, when I taught math, I used to tell my students, your life is a story problem. And he's exactly right. I mean, you're never going to get just a math equation in life. So, you know, that's a great analogy to what we've been talking about here. So, and I kind of wanted to piggyback a little bit. First of all, my judge panel, that was not me. That was other teachers that had those kinds of connections. So my judge panels were usually teachers and administrators, which I mean, still very nice, but not executive chefs. But
I'll still drink to that.
But the cross-curricular part is the key part that you mentioned. Yeah. So, and I'm rewinding back earlier in my career when I was working at that school, how the students that I had in U.S. history, my teaching partner next door taught English. We had the same students. Mm-hmm. At different times, but we had all of the same students. So she and I, Jamie Rawson, wrote the foreword for my book, one of my best friends. So hi, Jamie. She and I would come up with all sorts of projects together that involved both of our classes. But there was one in particular that we started to do before she left the classroom into her current role, where she would teach The Great Gatsby. She would do it at the same time that I was doing the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So perfect little marriage of those two concepts right there. But then we upped the ante because again, we had the marketing and the culinary students, where the culinary students had to create a menu of 1920s-esque foods.
Love it.
That would have been at Jay Gatsby's party, for example. And then the marketing kids designed the menus and marketed the whole party or whatever you want to call it. And I mean, it was very elaborate. And after Jamie went into her current role, and Samantha Bledsoe, who was my partner for the next 2 years after that, she continued it, and we built it even further from there. Because Jamie and I, we did a good job of that first year, but Samantha and I got even better with it as it went on. And I missed that because I'm in a different role now, different school. So and it doesn't have that culture. And part of it is because I think that a lot of teachers, they see that kind of thing And they know, like, oh, or I shouldn't say they know. They think that I can't do that. That's too much to bite off right off the bat.
Right.
So what do you think, or what do you say to teachers that are timid or hesitant to start to kind of flip their assessment models, whether it be project-based learning, whether it be game-based learning, whether it be like even as much as rather than a written essay or multiple choice, you sit down one-on-one with a kid and ask them a broad question about what you've been going over for 2 weeks and have them tell you what they know about it. So how do you approach teachers that are hesitant about that?
Right. That's a fantastic question. I say start slowly. You know, don't think tomorrow I'm going to change everything that I'm doing, because that's probably not going to happen. If a teacher doesn't naturally do those things, then they can start slowly and try one thing. Pick one thing that you feel comfortable doing and do that thing. Try to, you know, go out of the box, or, you know, not be sort of stuck in what we've done. I mean, I know teachers who teach the same thing for 24 years. You know, they're like, I've been teaching for 24 years, but they're teaching the same year 24 times, right? Not, I've been teaching for over 25 years. And I can tell you that I've never taught, even when I teach the same class, even in the same year, but to different students, it's never the same. It's going to be different. I'm going to refine it. I'm going to change it. I might borrow some ideas, but you have to start somewhere. You have to start small. You can't think, okay, I just need to change everything radically right now, unless you're able to do that. But otherwise, a person really just needs to pick a thing. What's that one thing I'm going to do? I'm going to feel comfortable with it. It's the same thing with tech tools. You know, most people are completely overwhelmed with the idea of adding technology into their classrooms. And that's why I say, pick one thing that you connect with, that you love, that's easy for you, and that you're going to do, and then do that thing. And then you can move on after you're comfortable with that. Then you move on and you do the next thing and the next thing until it just becomes easy. And it does become easy, because it becomes the way you think after a while. And I do want to say, you can start like this. When I used to give tests a million years ago, my tests were crazy. They were the wackiest tests, and they were almost always open-ended. I hated giving close-ended things, and I remember thinking I had to do that because that's what teachers did. But even then, I would throw on all these crazy questions that they had to think about, or they had to write, or they had to be creative with. So that's the next thing. If you feel like you still have to give tests, change your test. Don't give multiple choice. Do something else. Do something interesting with your tests. I talked to school that insisted on finals, and it was the kind of final you had to give that could go in the Scantron thing. And I said, okay, fine, I will make a final like that if you want. But they also have to do this project. Mm-hmm. And I gave the students all of these amazing choices, and those were phenomenal. Those were incredible. It was the ones particularly on Macbeth were just amazing. And I was like, all right, so you guys do this thing, do this Scantron test, but this is what I really want you to focus on. So I was able to talk the school into that. And sometimes that's what you have to do. You just have to like buck the system a little bit at a time.
Right. Well, and I think this kind of goes along with Kyle's question, is like, what about those? Because you're going to have those people that are like, well, I just do it this way. And how do you, I mean, what's your sales pitch to those people? Because I always think about the teacher who's like, well, I've always done it this way, and it works for me. And
what but it I doesn't. Say, but that's, it doesn't. I can't just, first of all, it may work for them, because it means they don't have to work very hard.
Because it works for them, not necessarily for kids.
But it doesn't work for their students.
Right.
And what I want to say to them is, every year when you have new students, those students are completely different than the ones the year before. And what might have worked for the students the year before might not work for these students. And times have changed. I mean, like I said, I've been teaching for 25 years. I can tell you, things have changed so much in the last 10, 15 years. It's just, and even in the last 5 years, I mean, things are so different, and they're going to be even more different after this pandemic. So we have to alter the way we look at education. It has to be a growing organism. It has to be growing and changing and improving. And if we're not, that's one of the things I love about working at Arete, because even though it was an amazing school, never once did Jim say, okay, we're done. This is good. Let's just keep it like this. every year, like that's all we did is talk about how can we make this better? How can we make this better? What else can we do? And it's always evolving and always growing and changing. And, you know, so that's what I think education just can't be stagnant. We can't be stuck. So yeah, that this is the way I've always done it. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah. Things have changed in the last 365 days, John says. And that's really, really true. It's really true. Yeah, this is almost like the 1 year anniversary when everything shut down. So it's pretty intense. But
absolutely. So now, kind of shifting gears a little bit, you were also a published author. So you released a book a few years ago that I'm interested to hear a little bit more about.
So the book is called The Jewish Educator's Companion. And the publishers came to me because in addition to teaching in the general ed world, I teach in the Jewish educational world. And it's very difficult for teachers there they might read about project-based learning or understanding by design or game-based learning or something. They might read a book or hear a podcast or something, but the examples given are never appropriate for Jewish educators. They just don't. So then they're like, well, I don't really know how to apply this, right? So Berman House was, they're a huge Jewish educational publishers, and they came to me and said like, yeah, this would be a great, we need this. So I just kind of poured my heart into it, and I took everything that I know about education and also about Jewish education specifically and kind of poured it in there. And it's basically like 18 workshops. Each chapter is like a workshop that I gave, you know, which because I give these workshops. So I basically, it's just like sort of taking a workshop. So it's really great. A lot of the ideas in there are just stuff that's great for general education. And I keep saying that I'm going to make a general education version of it. But right now I'm working on another book that deals with authentic and creative assessments. So that's going to be my next book. And that's for the general ed world.
So please forgive me because I'm very naive to the Jewish religion, but really all religions. I'm just not a very religious person, and I'm not very knowledgeable about any religion. But what are some examples of things that many teachers may be looking at, but you mentioned that just does not apply to the Jewish educator? What's something that you can give for an example?
So let's say I'm reading a book about project-based learning or understanding by design, or I take a course like I did a week-long course in understanding by design years and years ago, and every example is about math, science, English, history, right? And then those things aren't, you know, if it's a Jewish day school, there is, you know, they are learning those things. But this is really for the teachers who are teaching Torah, which is, you know, and Talmud, which is like Jewish law and Jewish philosophy and Hebrew language, you know, different topics that are central to Judaism, and applying those same ideas, you know, doing my deeper learning games, even my lenses of questioning. I have two versions of my kit and two versions that I teach. One that I teach using all general education examples, and one that I teach that's all Jewish education examples. And sometimes when I'm teaching at a day school that has both, then I do both kinds of examples so that everybody can get something out of it. But that's the thing. I mean, when you're doing professional development, I want it to be something that the people can use, whether it's a book, a podcast, a workshop, coaching, whatever it is that they can use tomorrow. I want them to be able to think about something and how can I apply this? And I can do this tomorrow because I've seen the examples, or I've heard about it, or I'm inspired to do it. And that's just really my goal. I don't know if that answered your questions.
No. Yeah, I'm super I'm glad Kyle asked that, because I was thinking, okay. And I too am ignorant of that. And now that you bring that up, I think about, okay, so I think about, you know, we live in a very, you know, public education, or even if you're a charter school, things, this is how we do things. But then you don't think about a Jewish day school, what you're describing, or a Catholic school, or any of the schools.
Yeah,
they have a different, it's just a different way that, I mean, way is not the right word, but it's, they have a different curriculum.
Well, they have what's called, and I don't know if this is true. I imagine this might be true for like Muslim schools or Catholic schools or something. I don't know, but I imagine it's true. We have a double curriculum.
Right.
Which means that in addition to all the main subjects, the students also have a whole nother slew of subjects that they're doing. So like in a typical school that doesn't use block scheduling, and by the way, I'm a huge proponent of block scheduling. But for people who don't, let's say they have 5 or 6 subjects during a day. So now add like 4 or 5 more to like, you know, different ones during the week and stuff, but it's, there's a lot. I mean, there's also the after school programs, and a lot of my professional development is for the after school programs where the kids go to public school or private school during the day. And then after school or on Sundays or whatever, that's when they learn the, you know, the Jewish stuff. And so those are, you know, like holidays, Jewish holidays and things like that, that, you know, obviously when somebody's writing a book on project-based learning, they're not thinking about that.
Right.
So I try to do that for them so that they can use those examples the next day.
That's super. That's amazing. That's truly something that never crossed. And it probably should have crossed my mind. But again, because I live in a public school world and I think, okay. And I would think also that there's a lot of opportunities for that cross-curricular, like you're talking about.
One would hope, and then it doesn't happen. And then that's one of my biggest things about that world is trying to get that cross-curricular.
Right.
Just that's one of,
I coached football for a few years at a small private Christian school. And I still remember during the first practice, I can't remember if it was before practice or after practice at this point, when the head coach, we're all together as a team, asked that everybody bow their head in prayer and then leads a prayer. And right away, my eyes just lit up. I'm like, what are you doing right now? Because public school teacher, I'm like, we're going to get sued. But then like 3 seconds later, I realized where I'm at, you know, because I had coached in the public schools for a few years and then went to this private Christian school. But like you said, at this school, those students had, I think, 6 or 7 classes, your math, your science, your English, whatever. And then one of their classes, regardless of their age level, they had a Bible study class where, and, you know, in my experience from friends growing up and everything, Bible study was, if you're a Catholic, you usually went on Wednesday nights,
right?
You know, and then there was Sunday school for various denominations. Right. And in my town, there was a very small synagogue in my hometown of 10,000. And I honestly can't remember any of my friends that were Jewish or anything, but they had their own thing that I was unaware of because I just wasn't aware of anybody in my hometown that was Jewish. But and then for the Muslim students in my hometown, there wasn't a mosque or anything. In fact, they actually went to the Catholic school, which I found very, to this day, I still find very intriguing because there's all these different crossroads between Judaism, Islam, and Christianity. There's different interpretations and different people that are in different roles within the various holy books, from what I understand. Again, I'm very, very naive to religion as a whole. I know parts of it based on the study of it as a history versus the belief system, I should say. But when you wrote the book, was it designed more for teachers in a Jewish day school, or was it for just Jewish educators in general? Like maybe Jewish educators in the public school even?
Well, it wasn't meant for teachers who happen to be Jewish. It was meant and are teaching just general studies. It was meant specifically for people who are teaching Jewish education, very specifically. Because otherwise, I mean, if you're teaching math and you happen to be Jewish, you could just, you know, you can learn it from somewhere else. Like I can, like, that's a different thing. But yeah, so it was specifically for people who were teaching Jewish subjects to use. Yeah. And I do want to say just something funny. When I was beginning my teaching career and I was teaching like Torah studies, it's called Tanakh. And that's what I was teaching. And so people would ask me if I taught in public schools. And I would say, no, the subject that I teach is completely illegal in public schools. They didn't know what I was teaching, but I just wanted to be really mysterious. And they'd be like, wow, what are you teaching? Like, what?
Now we're into it.
They were super excited.
So it was a cooking class in the range of, say, Walter White. No, I'm just kidding. that would be the
dream. I just went too far.
So as we're starting to kind of wrap things up a little bit, I do want to ask, though, real quick about your podcast and how you kind of got started with the podcast and where you're at with that and where people might be able to find your show.
So it started as conversations that I had with Jim Hahn, the head of Arete. And we'd have these amazing conversations about what we envisioned how great school could be if it just wasn't what it was now. And how amazing education could be and how we loved what we were doing at Arete, but we wanted everybody to be able to benefit from great education. Why we didn't want to just be so selfish to do it. So he kind of was like, but I have to, do this for the school. You can go off and do your podcast. And my background is actually drama. I was a drama major at NYU. So I love doing things like this. And I wanted to do something very different, like you guys are doing, with the beer, which I love, or scotch as the case may be. But I also wanted to do something very different. So I have fake commercials for products that we wish were real. They're commercial parodies for educational products that we wish were real. And I have all of my guests have to play the 5-minute game show, which is a game show that I write for them and the topic specifically. It's really funny because something that you said, Ben, is actually the topic of the next game show that I'm doing with Star Saxteen, and you're going to hear it.
That's so funny because when you were
having it twice, but the second episode is, I was like, oh, do I say that this is what the game show is?
So when we were talking about that, I was about to bring Star up because I was like, who totally would be in this she's written tons about this.
I just released an episode with her about the importance of questions.
Yeah.
But then we were like, oh, we want to talk about going gradeless too. Right. It'll be my third episode, but her take on it and our discussion on that. And so she had to play the game show twice. I have a few people who've been on a couple times and they have to play it twice. So they come on regardless of the fact that I make them play the game show. But it's really fun and they laugh a lot and we have a great time, but we also hopefully really inspire people, which is great. And I've been hearing such amazing feedback from people I don't even know. It's nice that my parents like it, but it really means something to me when I hear from people I don't know who they are and from all over the world telling me that how much they get out of my podcast, how much it means. And so that's really nice. So people can find it. And it's Overthrowing Education, and that is not a subtle title at all. And you can find it anywhere that podcasts are. I'm really grateful. It's doing really well, and I'm having a great time doing it. So.
Well, and I think that's cool that it's more, I think educational podcasts, this is just my personal take on it, can get so, we were joking about the whole pedagogy and it just gets to a point where you're like, oh, and Kyle and I have talked about this where it becomes an echo chamber where it's like, okay, I've heard the same topic. I've seen the same topic on a Twitter chat over and over. So I think it's cool that you're keeping it light. But then also, that's Overthrowing Education is a heavy subject, a much needed subject. Let's just be honest.
Yeah. And one of the things that I like to do is, I sort of have three kinds of episodes. They sort of fall into three categories. So one of the categories is looking at the pedagogical, how to improve your lessons and tools that you can take into the classroom and changing it and amazing stuff, very practical. And then I have things that are sort of systemic issues in the classroom, like going gradeless, like getting rid of standardized testing, all of those kinds of things. And then I have sort of the broader issues in society that affect the classroom. So I have a three-part series on eradicating racism in education, and I have things about how we can talk to each other better, and especially with people we don't agree with, how to handle those conversations. So I try to bring in those kind of three. Those are the three main styles that I have.
Well, and I have not listened yet, but I just subscribed as we were talking here, so I can start checking out, because I was sold on the the parody commercials for educational products, because all it reminded me of was Saturday Night Live. And I love Saturday Night Live. And then even the game show part of it, I mean, it's so much Saturday Night Live. Were you inspired by SNL at all with this idea?
The commercial parodies, 100%. It was that. And there was also a podcast. They're not on anymore, but it was called, I think it was called Wit. And it was really funny. And they used to do fake commercials. And so I was just like, I've always loved commercial parodies. It's one of my favorite parts on Saturday Night Live. And I love writing comedy. I love doing voices. I'm a performer. So I do a lot of voices. I have a lot of friends who are professional voice actors. And my husband is a voiceover voice, you'll hear. And so I love producing it. I used to work in editing, film editing. So I love editing it all together. I used to do sound effects editing and sound editing as well. So I love doing all of that kind of crazy stuff. And then, yes, I love it. And so that was really fun. And then the game show, actually, because I love, there's a podcast called Ask Me Another with Ophira Eisenberg. And it is one of my favorite podcasts. It's hilarious. It's like nerdy word games. And so I sort of, it's a little bit fashioned after that. It's inspired by that.
Awesome. So, well, thank you so very much for taking some time out to chat with us. We've been at this for almost an hour, and you know it's a good one when you don't realize it's been that long. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for having a drink with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that is our goal. We steal ideas from other educators, and we get to have a drink at the same time. So it's always a win-win for us, and I hope for our guests as well. So
perfect. Thank you so much.
We'll stick around because we do have our last little bit here. But first, so keep this conversation going, listeners, by sharing your thoughts on today's topics by emailing us at info@beeredupodcast.com. Tweet us at beeredupod. Use #beeredupod while you're at it. Hit us up on Facebook at beeredupodcast, all one word. You will get notifications for our live streams when we do our episodes and our new segment, What's in the Fridge? That we'll be doing on there and YouTube. And speaking of YouTube, you can subscribe to our channel at bit.ly/beeredu YouTube. Follow us on Instagram at beeredupod. Follow Batsheva on Twitter at Overthrowing Ed. But there was another one too. There was two other ones. Okay, at Batsheva Frankel. We'll have that in the show notes as well. Mm-hmm. Voice message in the Anchor app if you want to leave us one. Leave us a review wherever you listen. And Ben, if they want to be a guest on the show, what does one have to do?
Yeah, all you need to do is go to the website, beeredupodcast.com. You click on that contact and subscription info link, and you just complete the guest form. You'll get in the queue and, you know, tell us what you're passionate about, and we'd love to have you on the show. And I think we also have to thank, you know, BeerEDU Podcast is a part of two groups promoting our work and of other great podcasters. We're part of the Codebreaker Podcast Network, and you can find and listen to other great educational podcasts like Staff Room Podcast, STEM Every Day, Teachers on Fire, My EdTech Life. Check them out at codebreakeredu.com. And then also, big thanks to School Rubric for featuring the BeerEDU Podcast. And the mission of School Rubric is to help schools, educators, parents, and students help tell their stories so that stakeholders can make the best choices about enrollment and staffing. And check them out at schoolrubric.com because they have a ton of great content for educators all over the world. And stick around, Batsheva, because Kyle is going to school us on something that I swear to God, we've already talked about this.
You know what? I look back and we've talked about pieces of this. Yeah, you and I have talked about this, but we never did it as an official topic. And that's the question about why are beer bottles clear, green, or brown? Now, this is another one of those topics like, how have we not done this? Yes. How have we not talked about this one? So when you shop for beer, specifically bottled beer, you're going to notice that you're going to see beer most of the time in a brown bottle.
Yes.
But there's varieties that are either green or clear. And really, why is that the case? So it goes back to when brewers first started using glass bottles. They realized that beer would last longer. It would remain fresh if it was in glass. And this was obviously before cans that keeps beer even fresher than glass. But the problem is that beer would become skunky when it got exposed to sunlight. So because they were using clear glass, light and beer do not mix. So it'll skunk your beer out. Heat is another thing that'll do that. So, and you know, heat with sunlight, they go hand in hand. So your beer would not last very long. So, and the reason why is because UV rays interact with chemicals in hops, and that creates this reaction that gives it that skunky taste. And it's actually the chemicals that skunks release, it's very similar in chemical composition. Really? Wow. Yeah, that I found that very interesting. I am not a chemist, so I don't know the exact reaction and chemical makeup of those things, but they are very similar. So what brewers started to do, realizing that it was sunlight that was doing this, they started to use tinted glass, specifically brown glass, because the thought was this tinted glass will cut down the effect of sunlight. So, and kind of the thought behind it was, if we wear sunglasses to shield our eyes from the light, why wouldn't it work for the beer? So, and they weren't wrong. So brown glass does cut down on those UV rays and the effect that it has on beer. The problem became is that during and immediately after World War II, brown glass was in short supply.
Okay.
So now brewers had to come up with some sort of solution to this brown glass shortage, knowing they didn't want to turn to clear glass because that was one of the main problems of skunking out beer. So they went to green glass instead. Hmm. So what you end up getting, though, is a lot of companies, specifically European brewers, started to realize that higher quality beer in a green glass looks a lot better than low quality beer in a clear glass. So Think about it like Heineken versus Miller High Life. So I'm not a fan of either one of them, really. So I'll drink a High Life every now and then just because that's old college beer right there. But I've never really highly enjoyed Heineken all that much. But
full disclosure, I will buy Miller High Life before I'll buy Heineken.
Wow.
You know what?
Can I share what I drank when I drank beer in one of my 20s?
Absolutely.
Go.
Corona with a lime.
in a clear bottle.
I'm going to ask you, is it a clear bottle? What's up with that?
But you're not drinking that after it sat in the sun for 3 days, though, are you?
No,
you're not. No. So
I'm not.
I'm not
that
sure.
That beer's made to be drank fast.
Yes, and it has to be ice cold, in my opinion. So
yes,
yeah. And drink with a shot of tequila. I'm pretty sure
that nothing wrong with that either. So, so for a while, what you had was higher class beers, especially those European beers. They came in the green ones, and that's why, especially like there was that time during the late 70s and early 80s. Where imported bottles of beer became kind of the thing, where people didn't want to just drink, you know, the American macros. Right. So that really made those popular at that time. But today, that glass color doesn't make much of a difference because glass makers now, they can treat the glass with a UV protection coat. That even on the even on the clear glass, it can cut down on the UV rays, and the beer is going to be a lot better. And you still don't want to leave your beers sitting out in the sun. Because it is going to have an effect, even with the clear coat, even with the brown glass, whatever it may be. But again, it's not going to have that same effect like it once did.
Wow. You know what? You gave a whole new meaning to Beer EDU because I just got totally schooled about beer and I'm so excited. Like I learned so much. I can't wait to share this information. That's amazing.
Well, it is one of those. That is one of those things that I think everybody, you don't have to, I mean, because sometimes we get way out in the weeds about certain kind of beers and our love of that. But this is a very common question that I think people have is like, why is some in brown? Why is some in green? And why is some in clear?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to, and Kyle, you're right. I think it's mostly European importers use green. I'm trying to think of is it Rolling Rock is probably the only one I'm thinking of that has a green bottle.
For an American beer, that's the only one I can think of. When I'm thinking bottles of beer in green glass, I think Heineken first. But I think also like Beck's is another one that is in that green bottle. But I am struggling to think of some other ones. But yeah, pretty much everything else, even the macro beers for the most part are in brown with a few exceptions, like your Miller High Life is in a clear one. Right. And then Coronas are in a clear bottle. Pacifica is in clear. So yeah, a few of your Mexican breweries are in clear bottles as well.
Isn't there one that's in blue bottles now? Am I wrong? I feel like I saw that. I used to bartend, by the way, a million years ago.
Wow.
I'm not aware of a blue one, but that doesn't mean it doesn't exist. No.
I'm going to send it to you. I'm going to take a picture and send it to you.
I'm trying to think of the name of the brewer. It's a Belgian brewer, but I want to say the name of the beer is Delirium, and it's got like a pink elephant on the bottle. That's actually in a white, almost like clay pot looking bottle.
It's like a clay. Yes, I know which one you're talking about.
Yeah.
So, and I think it is a Belgian.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, and I'm curious because I think there's been a trend. We're moving away from bottles. I think a lot of microbreweries now are doing cans.
Cans are cheaper. They're more portable. Like I can take a can of beer in a pool and not worry about shattering it in the pool. And then they pack out real nice. Ben, you and I have talked about this, about going skiing. Oh, yeah. And you throw some cans in the back. You pop a can while you're on that 20-minute ride to the top of the mountain in the lift. Down that beer and then crush the can, put it back in your backpack. So that's part of it. And then again, the light part of it, cans block out all the light. So your beer stays fresher in a can for much longer than it does in glass.
That's why I think a lot of brewers, I'm thinking of like the breweries I've gone to, have moved away from doing a growler and doing the crowlers. So they're doing the cans, the big cans instead of the...
Which is also very nice because I've got a crowler in my fridge right now that I bought 2 months ago. And when I pop that thing, it's going to be great. Whereas a growler would have lasted me maybe a week.
Yeah.
Unless you get one of those ones with the vacuum sealed top with the rubber stopper. Those will last a little longer. But
I have those. And I will be honest, if you go more than 2 weeks, the beer's not as good. It loses it loses its carbonation.
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, there. Little bit of info on the color of bottle glass.
There we are. Well, Sheva, thank you so much for being on the show. It was awesome to have you. Super excited about the stuff you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so much fun, you guys. I really appreciate it.
Yes, definitely. I'll be checking out Overthrowing Education here in the next couple of days. I walk every morning about 4 miles, so I got some time to catch up on the back catalog a little bit there. So I was just scrolling through and saw some of the guests. I'm really excited to go back and check it out.
There's some awesome guests on there. So yes, people, if you're listening to this episode, check her out. We'll have links in the show notes.
So Ben, that's a wrap on 99, which means next episode is number 100.
Yes, the big 100.
Yes, indeed. So very excited about that one. So, and listeners, of course, as always, thank you for listening, your support. And until next time, may the malts and the hops be with you.
Right on.